welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 22nd of November 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another week. We've got another glorious week to look forward to and we have the past week to discuss today with Max Musson from Western Spring, my co-host. Max, how are you doing today? What's life like where you are?
Life is reasonably good, actually. It's, weather-wise, we've got dry but overcast weather, but other than that, it's very good, and I'm feeling, very healthy. I've been out exercising earlier on today, so I've done a bit of cycling, done a bit of weight training, that sort of thing. So I'm feeling good.
It's a positive mood all round, actually, with the Rittenhouse trial as well in America, with him being found innocent. Absolutely fantastic news. I think everybody is in a good mood. Perhaps that might have affected you. And also, you are telling me that one of your predictions that you made the other week has actually come true. Do you want to let the listeners know what that was?
Yeah, this was a prediction that I made last weekend, actually. And I thought perhaps I was delving too far into the future, and after we'd done the show and I was thinking back over what I'd said, I thought perhaps I might have actually exaggerated a little too much in my prediction. But it was where we had been talking about the Albert Hall and the program that had been put on, a program of remembrance that had been put on at the Albert Hall, and I'd said about how there was a disproportionately large ethnic minority content to that, and I said that if there was a continuation of this multiculturalization of our society and of the remembrance events that were being taken around the country, that we'd soon have a situation where people would be where the music being played would be hip-hop, where people would be rapping and possibly even twerking. And after the show, as I say, I thought perhaps I might have perhaps gone a little bit too far in doing that. But then reading through the news as we've gone through this last week, I realised that I've actually been beaten to it, and that far from this being something that's in the future, is actually something which is already in the past, because it appears that this last Remembrance Day at the Imperial War Museum, they put on a service of remembrance there with which is called Breaking the Silence. And at the end of the service, at the end of the 2 minutes silence in honour of the war dead, there was a performance by a group of people from what was it been reported to be the MIDI Music Company, or Mighty Music Company it might be, which involved them going into a rap, which greatly offended the people who were listening to, who were there, who were in attendance. And by all accounts, as far as the newspapers are concerned, a number of people got up and walked out in disgust. There were people who went to the officials of the Imperial War Museum and asked if they could have their donations back, because they didn't want to donate money to an organization which was so woke. There were, by all accounts, there were references to white privilege in this rap, to how racist Britain is. And from the Times, I've sort of extracted some words that were apparently included in this. And one of the people that was involved in organising the whole thing was described as being a talented wordsmith, performing as a spoken word artist and a hip hop MC. And the quotations that are in the Times article were when some remember, do they see the same faces, white faces from Western places? This was the Second World War, yet how many remember it wasn't only Churchill who fought? The same man had a hand in the famine in 1943, wiping out 3 million Bengalis. Denial, displacement, malnutrition, starvation, without any apologies. And so, that's the kind of flavour of this rap that was played at the end. And as I say, quite a large number of people were insulted by it. If you go to the Imperial War Museum's website, there are still some of the TripAdvisor reports that people had posted there that just members of the public who were disgusted by the whole thing. And It also continued with stating that remembrance occasions, forget those whose skin isn't porcelain. We failed to remember 1/6 of all our forces were South Asian, failed to remember anyone who wasn't Caucasian. And then it all ended apparently with this group of people chanting, "We won the war, we won the war." And so that gives us a pretty clear indication of the mentality of the people who are becoming increasingly influential in our society and who are becoming increasingly influential at these at remembrance ceremonies. It's something that that I think the public in general need to think very seriously about and to become concerned about.
Yeah, that's absolutely scandalous. I mean, the people that were chanting, "We won the war, we won the war," was that a multicultural troop? Was that the black hip hoppers?
That's the impression I've gleaned from reading the newspaper article, yes.
Yeah, I wonder what war they were referring to. Churchill did engineer this famine in Bengal, but what has that got to do with Remembrance Sunday? Remembrance Sunday is about remembering the fallen soldiers in the war. You can bring up Churchill and Churchill's deficiencies at other times throughout the year, perhaps on the anniversary of the famine, on some date that is important to that. But to bring it up at the Remembrance Sunday service for the fallen war dead is absolutely the height of disrespect. I'm very pleased to see that this created a big scandal and people were asking for their money to be given back. I mean, imagine that, giving money to charity and then asking for it to come back. Heads really need to roll over this. I mean, this is really shocking and offensive. But you know, this is the way that we are going. And the more of this we have, the more people there will be that wake up to it and that want to look for an alternative, and will find us, and they'll read about us, and they'll read about how horrible and nasty and evil we are, and then they'll discover us, and they'll listen to us, and they'll realise that they've actually been told a lot of lies about us, and in actual fact, we're the good guys that are speaking up for them, and they'll end up joining us. But yeah, I mean, that was so quick, Max, to have actually occurred on the day that you were talking about last week. But, as I said, I mean, we're just waiting for it to happen, basically, weren't we?
Well, we can see with the pulling down of statues, etc. It's fairly evident that as far as the Black Lives Matter people are concerned, nothing is sacred in this country, and everything has to be viewed through the lens of their feelings of past oppression. And nothing else matters apart from that. And so I think we're going to see more of this in the future. And as you say, yeah, more and more people are going to become disgusted by it. And it's going to provoke people into giving us support at the end of the day. So, you know, that's perhaps the silver lining around the cloud, but we've just got the cloud for the moment.
And this was this televised at all, or was this just a report that you read about there?
No, it was reported in on the Daily Mail website, the Daily Express website, and also the Times website.
Oh, I must have missed that. I know you were watching something else on the television that piqued your interest this week as well.
Yeah, that's right. And again, people who are sort of Black Lives Matter fanatics, they like to create the impression that that white society has unduly profited, not just from the slavery that only a very minority, a very small minority of white people actually engaged in during the period of the transatlantic slave trade, but also they like to give the impression that lots of white people benefited from having compensation paid to them by the British government, and they're sort of extremely angry at the fact that compensation was paid to slave owners when the slave owners agreed to give up their slaves. But I'm quite interested by there's a TV series that's been on for a number of years now, actually, which is called Who Do You Think You Are? And I just happened to notice that there was an episode of it on a couple of nights back, and the person being featured in it was a current TV presenter and ex-women's footballer, international footballer, a lady by the name of Alex Scott, who's of mixed race. And this program was investigating her ancestry in the same way that that's what they do each with each program. They pick a celebrity and investigate their ancestry. And as they were talking to Alex Scott, she comes over as being a very well-meaning person, and if a little bit naive, but she's, as I say, a well-meaning person. But in discussing her family's ancestry, she originally starts talking to her mother, and her mother mentions the fact that only a couple of generations back are Lithuanian Jews. And Alex Scott goes off to speak to it's either an aunt or a cousin about one of these characters, and this person was called Phil G, the G standing for Gittelson, so his name is Philip Gittelson presumably. This relative that Alex Scott visits mentions to her that he was at Cable Street and fought with the fascists at Cable Street, and so this is a sort of very sort of hackneyed storyline that I should think virtually anybody with any Jewish ancestry that lived in London around about that sort of time would probably claim to have been at Cable Street and done their bit to thwart Oswald Mosley. And Alex Jones, in her sort of naivety, not Alex Jones, Alex Scott, in her naivety, she sort of accepts all this. And I can see the program unfolding, because the next element in the program is for them to start to explore Alex Scott's father's ancestry. And he is from Jamaica. And so she ends up going over to Jamaica and visits a number of her sort of distant relatives that are still living in Jamaica. And the first thing that struck me was the fact that these distant relatives weren't poor. They weren't wealthy by any stretch of the imagination, but they had land, they had houses, and they weren't living in squalor or anything of that sort. So they were reasonably well-heeled, and that was, you know, nothing wrong with that. But the point is that as they were then talking about the various generations of her family's ancestry in Jamaica, this historian who's finding documents, etc., to talk through with her and to show her where her ancestors featured in Jamaican history, produces a document. And as they go through, they talk about her four times great grandfather called Robert Francis Coombs. And it becomes apparent partway through this document, as this historian is reading through, that this chap, who was of mixed race himself, actually owned slaves, and not just owned slaves, but he owned 26 of them. And as this is revealed, you can see sort of Alex Scott looking slightly horrified, actually, and her eyes kind of fill up with tears, and she realizes that there's something it's kind of embarrassing in her family's history, and something which goes against what she states in the program is, you know, goes against all of her values. And it then, as the historian reads on through this particular document, it becomes apparent that not only did this Robert Francis Coombe own 26 slaves, but he was compensated for them by the British government when he eventually gave them up. And so he didn't give up these slaves voluntarily himself. And when he was forced to give them up by law, he didn't give them up for nothing. He gave them up and was compensated by the British government, the same as all of the white slave traders that existed, or slave owners that that existed in those times. And so it just made me think to myself, well, I wonder how many people of West Indian extraction that live here in Britain and who are very right on when it comes to calling for black lives to matter, and who you know, occasionally you see individuals coming forward and saying that it's dreadful the way in which their ancestors were exploited by the British historically, and that we perhaps should pay them reparations or something of that sort. But then when you delve into somebody's history like this, it then becomes apparent that, you know, some of their ancestors weren't innocent slaves. Some of their ancestors were the owners of slaves, and they also kept those slaves until they were paid to give them their freedom as well. And so I imagine there's probably quite a few Black Lives Matter campaigners here in the UK who would be rather left with egg on their face if we were to delve too deeply into their ancestry as well.
Well, I should imagine there's lots of them. I mean, you had lots of blacks that paid for their freedom, or their owners gave them their freedom because they really liked them, and they owned black slaves as well. I mean, there were Indians that owned black slaves. The blacks themselves in Africa, they all owned slaves. I mean, that was just the way that they did things. I think it would be very, very difficult to find any black person or white person alive today that wasn't involved in the slave trade in some way, either selling them or purchasing them or being a slave. I mean, if you look at the Irish and the Scots in America today, a lot of their ancestors were slaves. They were indentured servants. Obviously, if you look at most of the blacks in America today, then they were also slaves. But if you go back further to their ancestors and the ones that were actually in Africa, they will have been related to slave traders. It's just a rather unfortunate part of history. And, you know, what I really don't understand is the way people look at it today. It's as if they think that these people were getting something for nothing. The slave owners were getting something for nothing. They weren't. They paid a lot of money for the slaves. They paid the equivalent of £10,000 a head for them. And then they gave them food and lodgings and clothes. And they expected them to pick fruit or pick cotton on the farm to pay for that food and lodgings. And when slavery was done away with, these slaves were like, well, who's going to pay for us now? Who's going to provide for us now? It's all very well, you've given us our freedom, but who's going to put the food on the table? Who's going to put the roof over our heads? And the owners were very generous, and they actually gave they gave the slaves land. They gave them implements, farming implements. I mean, a fair amount of the money that was actually given in compensation to the owners actually went on things to give to the slaves, because they were looked upon as members of the family. In most cases, it was a friendly relationship between them, and they looked up to the owner as some kind of a father figure. If you look at a book, I think it's called The Truth About Lynching in the South, it gives all the statistics for everything that was actually given to them, the farmland, the farming implements, the pigs, the chickens, all the instruction and the schools that were set up for them, and all these things that were actually just given to them gratis by their owners. So it amazes me that people just think that they were getting something for nothing. And when you brought up the bit there about the fascists and defeating the fascists in EastEnders at the moment, they've got a storyline where they have a fascist, and they call him a fascist as well, and obviously he's a really nasty piece of work. He's already beaten up some Muslim taxi driver for no reason other than he's a Muslim, and left him in hospital, and then he's moved on to spray painting a swastika on the local mosque. And his sister is going out with a white Muslim. And of course, you can just see that his gang that he's involved in is going to beat up the white Muslim and also beat up the sister. And then he's going to regret his terrible dalliance with the far right. But it's all just so unbelievable. They've just got this horrible character who does horrible things, and that's presented to us as this is what the Nazis are. This is what the far right are. I mean, it's total social engineering, and it is so predictable. It was, I guess, 6 months back they had somebody else. I think it was Dot's husband. Dr. Legg, the Jewish doctor. He came back into the series for about a week or so, and again the skinheads arrived, and they painted a swastika on his door, and of course, we know from experience, most of the time when you see these swastikas that have been put somewhere, it's not actually done by a nationalist. It normally turns out that it's actually done either by somebody black or done by somebody Jewish. I mean, the biggest hate crime that ever happened in 2017, I think it was, during the Trump campaign, and there were literally hundreds of bomb threats that were phoned in to synagogues. And it turned out that it was this Jewish kid in Israel that was doing this. Then we have Jussie Smollett with the rope pull, the garage rope pull that was on the garage door that he said was this was another one that somebody said was a noose, and that wasn't a noose, it was just the pull on a garage door. And then you had Jussie Smollett that claimed that these white supremacists beat him up and put a hood over his head and all the rest of it. And it turned out that he'd actually paid two black actors to do this. And most of the time when this sort of thing happens, it's not actually nationalist. Why would a nationalist do something like that? It's just to portray us as the bad guys, basically. And it's so two-dimensional. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that, Max.
Only just to sort of say that I've heard of lots of these occasions where so-called hate crimes have actually been fabricated and don't really exist. It never actually took place in the way that was suggested. But the other thing to think about as well, though, is that the long-term effect of the transatlantic slave trade is that a very substantial population of people of African origin now live in the northern states of and the states of Central America, and have a much better standard of living than the people that were left behind who weren't enslaved and who lived as free people in Africa. And it's fairly sort of crystal clear that when slavery was abolished, there wasn't this big rush of all these slaves to go back over to their homeland in Africa and to resettle and live there, because they realized that they had a much better standard of living if they stayed in the United States or if they stayed in any other white countries that they'd been taken to. And so, you know, that in itself is in my view, a clear indication that, you know, whilst some people may have been taken into slavery against their will, and yet that's wrong, I've got no support for slavery whatsoever, the outcome for their progeny, their posterity, has actually been a beneficial outcome.
Well, and I think that was the way that it was looked upon by the government as well, because they did the same with white people. They thought, well, look at these white people in Scotland. They're not doing very much. They're not producing very much. If we sent them off to America as slaves, they would help build the new land over there, in the same way that they sent prisoners off to Australia and they built a civilization. And you had the Highland clearances. They did the same in Ireland. They picked up the Irish off the streets. They picked up the English, the villeins, the people that lived in the villages, and they stuck them on these boats and they sent them off to America. And the motive was, well, they're going to be better off over there. They're going to be able to own their own little bit of land eventually. They'll learn a trade and they'll help to build civilization. And yes, they are better off now than they would have been if they'd stayed here starving and at risk of being sent off to Australia for stealing a sheep or something like that. Eventually, they were able to buy their freedom after being indentured servants. And that was the mentality. People are going to be better off going to America as a slave than they would be living in the Highlands of Scotland or living in Ireland. And, you know, they probably thought the same thing with these Africans. You know, they felt the same thing with these Africans. What's going to happen to them if they stay there in Africa? If they're a slave in Africa, the chances are that they'll end up being sacrificed. They'll end up being eaten. If you're a slave in America, you end up with a wife being brought for you by your owner. You ended up being medicated. There was a creche provided for you. There was pension provided for you when you finished the end of your working life. And I don't want people to say, oh, you're sort of sugarcoating it. But I think we do have to provide a balance there. And all you have to do is look at the original source documents to find it. With all these things, you've got to have a balance. You can listen to the anti-slavery stuff from the day, and then you can listen to the pro-slavery stuff from the day, and you can get an idea that yes, there was bad behavior, yes, there were slaves that were mistreated, but in the same way as marriage is an institution, and yes, there are wives that are mistreated, there are wives that are beaten up. It doesn't mean that marriage in itself was wholly evil for everybody concerned. It was just the way of doing things for thousands of years. And the Africans themselves were the very last to give up on it.
Yes.
Well, there's another subject that I actually wanted to bring up as well. And this actually just happened yesterday. It appears that Sajid Javid has announced that there's going to be a big inquiry, a proper government inquiry into this, about medical devices showing racial bias. And this is absolutely incredible. And what they're actually talking about is the heart rate monitor, pulse rate monitor that you put on your finger. Nurses put it on your finger and it can tell what your pulse is. Well, apparently it's not so accurate when it's put on black fingers. And, you know, this just would seem obvious to me. Black people have thicker skin than white people do. And it's also much darker skin. It has melanin there. So obviously, a heart rate monitor that has been designed for Caucasians is not going to work so well on black people. And conversely, if there had been a heart rate monitor that was designed specifically for black people, it wouldn't work so well on white people. And yet they're complaining about this as if this was deliberately done, as if the people that invented it were white supremacists, as if these inventors had deliberately done this. They just hated other people's skin colours, and they deliberately created this pulse rate monitor that was not going to work so well for black people. And that's the attitude that is being said here. And Sajid Javid is actually going to investigate this, because this is what they think, that it was deliberately done. And whenever this sort of thing happens, because it also recently happened with x-rays and MRI machines, they said MRI machines can tell whether a woman is black from a mammogram. Well, yes, because black women tend to have larger breasts. And then they said x-ray machines can tell whether somebody is black because when they do x-rays of the hands. Well, yes, of course, because black people tend to have longer fingers, so of course it's going to pick up on that, and it would be able to tell the race. And they're investigating that, of course. Why is it that these machines can see what race somebody is when they're actually looking through the skin color? And you just end up thinking, these people that are complaining about this, why did they not just invent one for themselves? Okay, white people invented a heart rate monitor that works best on white people. Okay, well, why don't the black inventors get together and invent a pulse rate monitor that works best on black people? I mean, obviously, you can't make it so that it works best on everyone, because you're going to get false readings on the whites if you make it for black people, and you're going to get false readings on the blacks if you make it for white people like it is today. The simple solution is just to invent what you need for your own people, instead of complaining that white people didn't invent one for blacks as well. I mean, that's what's really going on. If it was white people doing that, I think they would be ashamed of themselves. Nobody seems to think of this. I mean, it's incredible. Did you hear about this, Maxwell? Did you hear about this MRI machines and X-rays that can now tell what people's race are?
Well, I did see the article by reporting on Sajid Javid. But the point is that you could have a machine that's got a dial on it, and so they can just twist the dial from sort of lily white skin through to the darkest skin. But then people would object to the fact that somebody was making a value judgment about the darkness of their skin, and so they would say that they were offended if somebody did that. Yeah, one of the things that sort of struck me during the course of the week, because there's been an issue about alleged racism in the world of cricket, and now it's being spread to alleged racism in the world of football, etc. The point is, if somebody is very thin-skinned and sensitive about having a joke made about them, or having anybody comment upon their race, then there is so much scope for them to pick on things and become, you know, massively offended by these things, even though in any other like sane world, people would just ignore this kind of thing. As far as these machines are concerned, it's very simple. You know, either have a machine that is ideally designed to work with white people, or have an alternative machine that's designed to deal with people with darker skin, or you can have a machine that's got a dial on it. But, you know, don't keep on being offended just because somebody makes mention of your race, or uses a slang term to describe your ethnicity. You know, why do people get so upset about it? You know, people, I've been called a Brit in the past. I don't get all annoyed about it, because Brit is an abbreviation of the word British. And so why should somebody get grievously offended by the fact that somebody uses an abbreviated form of Pakistani? Why would somebody get offended by that? Only somebody who's looking to become offended would become offended by that. This whole furore about race and you know, whether people matter, and whether it's all in my view a manufactured thing by the media and pandering to people who are overly sensitive and who are looking for some kind of a payday, in my view, where they can claim that they were discriminated against and that discrimination has stopped them from achieving what they wanted to achieve, and so therefore, you know, they're owed some money. I think that's the sort of attitude behind it.
Oh, it's absolutely manufactured, and I had to laugh when it was discovered that the cricketer in question had actually made some anti-Semitic tweets himself 10 years ago. And there's also photographs of him with a big bottle of champagne, drinking a bottle of champagne. And one of the criticisms he made was that because he was a Muslim and he was forced to drink, well, he looks like he's enjoying this drink to me with his champagne. I did a podcast on this last week, and again it is just they're concentrating all the government resources on that, on this inquiry into cricket, and now they're concentrating all the government resources onto racist medical devices. And as you say, Max, all they have to do is just put a dial on there, and if somebody is black, then you change the parameters that the machine works at. That's all you would have to do. It's this idea that one size fits all, everybody is equal. And therefore, if something doesn't have an equal outcome, it must be racist. And it's now gone so far that machines themselves are being called racist, and their inventors. It's ridiculous. Shall we go back into a better time in history, Max? Shall we get into our greatest Britons?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay. And just before we have the recap, I just wanted to pick up on something that we were talking about last week. We mentioned that on April 6th, 1909, Robert Edwin Peary, a 56-year-old commander on leave from the US Navy, together with Matthew Henson, his Negro servant and companion, reached the North Pole on their sixth attempt. And I thought I would have a little look at this and find out about this so-called Negro servant. And he's now described as an explorer. And he was actually admitted into the Explorer's Lodge or whatever it is as an honorary explorer about 50 years after this. And in 1912, the guy himself, he actually published a memoir about his Arctic explorations. And it's titled A Negro Explorer at the North Pole. But in this book, he actually describes himself as a general assistant, skilled craftsperson, interpreter and labourer. So he wasn't actually an explorer, but he was a very useful guy to have on the mission. He learned how to speak Inuit. He accompanied this Robert Peary. He accompanied him everywhere, and Robert Peary wanted him on this as on the crew that actually made it to the North Pole. And he claims that he was actually the first person to get there. But now it does look as if they didn't actually get there at all, because it was actually impossible to get that far in the amount of time that they put down in their diary. And I also looked at media representations, and there's a ton of media representations of this Matthew Henson, the black servant and companion, and there are none of Robert Peary, the actual explorer. And both of them appear to have been given a similar amount of honours. So I just thought it was worth elaborating on that before we get into the recap. You got any comments you want to make on that, Max?
Well, yeah, I think it's an example of a Negro who was a very useful chap, as you say, to have on an expedition like that, being given the same sort of credit as the people that accompanied him, or that he accompanied.
Oh yeah, he was definitely given that credit for his achievements. He was a very useful person to have on the crew. Well, last episode we heard about Scott's problems with raising funds for a second expedition, and how Ernest Shackleton had ended up breaking his word to Scott and travelling through Scott's patch at McMurdo Sound. We learned about Scott's marriage to a sculptor who was 15 years younger than him, and how she became pregnant just as he acquired enough money for the Terra Nova expedition. That year, the American became the first to get to the North Pole, and suddenly the whole world turned its attention to Antarctica, as it was the last place left to be conquered. Several nations now made plans to get there. Shackleton arrived back home and was given a knighthood. That's a knighthood that Scott was never actually given. And Scott started experimenting with motor sledges, and he went to work on forming the crew that he needed for his own expedition. Is there anything else you would like to add to that, Max?
No, it's a It must have been a very exciting time for people who had the right connections and the wherewithal to go on these expeditions in order to experience the glory of discovering new things and new lands.
I love the name they have for it. It's called the Heroic Age of Arctic Exploration, because they were all absolute heroes.
Yes.
Right, well, let's get into how he managed to form the crew. Money may have been slow in coming, but volunteers were coming in from all over the world. More than 8,000 men volunteered to actually join the expedition. 5 members of the original Discovery crew were accepted. Petty officers Thomas Williamson, Edgar Evans and Thomas Crean, also Chief Stoker William Lashley and William Heald. The scientists were carefully picked, and from the onset, Edward Wilson was Scott's first choice. 3 geologists were chosen, 2 Australians, Frank Debenham and T. Griffith Taylor, plus Raymond Priestley, who had been with Shackleton's Nimrod expedition. And I guess we should remember, I mean, he's getting Australians there, but they're also British, aren't they? They're English, because this was a big English thing. England needs to get there first, so they must have counted the Australians as still being English. Canadian Charles Wright was selected as the physicist, while George Simpson came from the Indian Meteorological Service. And again, the Indian Meteorological Service would have been run by white people. The one physicist who didn't go was the young lecturer from the University of Adelaide, Douglas Mawson, who was making his own plans, like many others, to explore an unmapped stretch of coast and country west of Victoria Land. In a letter to Griffith Taylor on February 15, 1910, Mawson wrote, "I'm almost getting up an expedition of my own. Scott will not do certain work that ought to be done. I quite agree that to do much would be to detract from his chances of the pole, and because of that, I am not pressing the matter any further. Certainly, I think he is missing the main possibilities of scientific work in the Antarctic by travelling over Shackleton's old route. However, he must beat the Yankees." The biologists were Edward Nelson and D.G. Lilly. And while Wilson was selecting the scientists, Scott and Evans worked on forming the rest of the crew. From the Admiralty came naval lieutenants Harry Pennell, navigator and magnetic observer, Henry Rennick in charge of the hydrographical surveys and deep sea soundings, and Victor Campbell. 2 lieutenant surgeons, G. Murray Levick and Edward Atkinson, were appointed, along with 26 petty officers and seamen. Various other volunteers were taken for a number of reasons. Herbert Ponting was a skilled, experienced photographer whose pictures taken during the Russo-Japanese War had been published in leading magazines in Great Britain and the United States. Apsley Cherry Garrard, aged 24 and a relative of Reginald Smith's, contributed £1,000 in order to be appointed assistant biologist. Captain L.E.G. Oates of the 6th Inniskilling Dragoons, who walked with a slight limp due to a wound received in the Boer War, also contributed a similar amount and was put in charge of the ponies, as this was his area of expertise. Like Oates, Henry Bowers of the Royal Indian Marines came from India to join the expedition. Bowers, a Worcester cadet, was a short, stocky man with red hair and a large nose, which quickly earned him the nickname Birdie. Another former cadet from the Worcester, Wilfred Bruce, joined the expedition. And this was Kathleen's, that's Scott's wife's, 36-year-old brother. Bruce was instructed to travel to Vladivostok and meet up with Cecil Mears, who had just selected 20 Siberian bred ponies and 34 sledge dogs for the expedition. The animals were escorted to Lyttelton via Japan and Australia. Losing only 1 pony and 1 dog on the long journey, the animals were inoculated 10 times and put ashore on Quail Island. So it's all systems go here now, and you can see that people are willing to pay money so that they can have a part on this trip. And again, you wouldn't really have that now. It would be people's expertise. And I'm sure Scott would rather have had people that were experts in their field rather than people that were willing to pay the money, but they've got to get there. And you can see that there's this nationalism verging on jingoism. We've got to beat the Yankees, but it's a friendly competition.
Also, though, the amounts of money are not, you know, they might not sound particularly large by modern day standards, but they would be massive by the sort of level of prices, etc., that would have prevailed in the early 1900s. And so, you know, if somebody has paid a very substantial amount of money, then you can be sure that they're going to absolutely work their socks off to make sure that the expedition works and is successful, rather than somebody who's just donated a small amount who has just turned up because they happen to be the right person in the right place at the right time. So I think there's a converse argument that when somebody puts in a substantial amount of money, then that they are very often the sort of person that you want.
Yeah, they're going to have a stake in it. That's a really good point there. They're going to have a lot invested in pulling the mission off, basically. Well, it's rather interesting here that they mentioned ponies. Perhaps Scott still retained fresh memories of the disastrous results with the dogs during his southern journey on the Discovery expedition, but for whatever the reasons, his transportation choices undoubtedly led to the expedition's final results. The motor sledges were obviously experimental, since none had ever been used before, while the ponies would prove to be an even weaker link in the disastrous chain of events. It is true that Shackleton took 19 ponies with him on his Nimrod expedition, but only 4 survived to actually set out on the journey towards the pole. Of these, one had to be shot at the second depot, another gave up at the third, and by the time they reached the foot of the Beardmore Glacier, only one was left. Soon afterwards, this pony fell into a crevasse, leaving Wild, who had been leading him, suspended by one elbow over the dark chasm. Scott planned to use the sledges to motor across the barrier as far as possible, establishing depots along the way, and the ponies would then take over and haul the sledges to the foot of the glacier. Scott felt that the animals would not be able to make it up the glacier, but would be a good source of fresh meat upon their return from the pole. In retrospect, it is felt that Scott would have had an easier go of it to the pole had he adequately trained men and dogs to make the assault. Nevertheless, Scott wrote, "In my mind, no journey ever made with dogs can approach the height of that fine conception which is realised when a party of men go forth to face hardships, dangers, and difficulties with their own unaided efforts, and by days and weeks of hard physical labour, succeed in solving some problem of the great unknown. Surely in this case, the conquest is more nobly and splendidly won." So he's thinking it's more noble for them to do it this way on ponies rather than thinking practically. This was the way that he thought as well. You know, what they were doing, they wanted to set a really good example to the whole country of what English men were capable of achieving, what white men were capable of achieving. It was... He was very noble, I think, in his aspirations.
Yes,
he took the harder route, basically, rather than the easy route. He wasn't somebody that would always choose the easiest route. On June the 1st, 1910, the Terra Nova was towed away from the Southwest India docks as cheering crowds stood by. Ponting, who was standing beside Scott, wondered what their homecoming would be like, and Scott answered, "I don't care much for this sort of thing." As the crowds cheered and the steamers whistled, "All I want is to finish the work we began in the Discovery, and then I will get back to my job in the Navy." Scott did not sail with the Terra Nova, as he remained behind in an attempt to raise additional funding, and then with his wife left the ship at Greenhithe, where he was presented 2 flags by Queen Alexandra, who was now the Queen Mother, one to be planted at the furthest south attained, while the second to be hoisted at the same spot and then brought back again. Scott stayed another 6 weeks before leaving for South Africa to join the ship, and Kathleen made the difficult decision of leaving young Peter, that's Scott's son, behind, and sailing on with Scott as far as Sydney. And they sailed in HMS Saxon on July the 16th, 1910, and were seen off by Wilhelm Filchner and Ernest Shackleton. Also aboard were Edward Wilson's wife, Ori, and Teddy Evans' wife, Hilda. They reached Cape Town on August the 2nd, 13 days before the Terra Nova. Like the Discovery, though, the Terra Nova was also a leaker. The leak wasn't too bad, but nevertheless, everyone had to take a turn at the hand pumps commencing at 6 a.m. and resuming every 4 hours around the clock. and when the ship reached the tropics, the heat was incredible. After leaving Madeira, the winds became so light that the engines were required. The men sweated and toiled as they fed enormous amounts of coal into the three furnaces. On July 25th, the Terra Nova anchored off uninhabited South Trinidad Island, some 700 miles east of Brazil. The Discovery had also visited the island in 1901 when a new petrel named after Wilson, the Estrellata Wilsoni, was found. Wilson and Cherry Garrard, armed with guns, went after the birds, and Lily looked for plants and rocks while Nelson and Simpson searched for new fish in pools. Five new species of spiders were collected and a new moth. After leaving the island, the ship went booming along before strong westerlies, and they arrived in Simon's Bay, Cape Town, on August 15, 1910, and the crew were soon reunited with Scott, and for the next few days, each member was left to himself to do as he pleased. So they're taking the women along on this trip, or at least to go out and meet the Terra Nova, and I'm not so sure that that was a good omen. To bring their wives with them. I don't think it's a good idea to really have your wives at sea. I think that's a bit of a tradition, is not to have women at sea, or at least it is on fishing boats.
Yes, I would have thought that as well. They also seem to be taking a fairly circuitous route to get down there as well, sort of going across to, what was it, Trinidad Island, and then heading across to Cape Town. So they must have crossed the Atlantic a couple of times in that journey.
Yeah, I think there's a sort of romanticism there, that they're romanticising it all rather than thinking we've got to use the least amount of fuel, we've got to plan it so that it's the correct route. And I think it was just, we're going to be able to do this. We're Englishmen. Of course, we're going to be able to do this. And sadly, they weren't. I mean, I was compiling the notes for this last night and I was just choked up doing the notes. It's going to be so difficult when I try to read it. Anyway, continuing. Although not happy about it, Wilson was instructed to take an ocean liner to Melbourne, as Scott took over command of the Terra Nova. Mrs. Scott, Mrs. Evans, Wilson and his wife all sailed together aboard the RMS Corinthic, and upon arrival in Melbourne, Wilson consulted with Professor Edgeworth David and selected a third geologist. Meanwhile, Scott was enjoying himself aboard the Terra Nova. The object of taking command at Cape Town was to acquaint himself with the crew and select the members of the two shore parties. One would remain at the expedition's base of operations in or near McMurdo Sound, carrying out scientific research, while the second party made the final assault on the pole. A splinter group of six men called the Eastern Party was to be dispatched in unexplored King Edward VII Land, 400 miles to the east, and this group would be led by Victor Campbell. The naval lieutenants Pennell and Rennick would remain in charge of the ship, and Scott would write to his mother, "My companions are delightful." After 6 weeks at sea, the Terra Nova reached Melbourne on October 12, 1910. Wilson loaded the wives and a bag of mail into a motor launch and set out to find the ship in pitch darkness. Kathleen wrote in her diary, "As they approached the ship, I heard my good man's voice and was sure there was no danger. So insisted, getting more and more unpopular. We at last got close to the beautiful Terra Nova with our beautiful husbands on board. They came and looked down into our faces with lanterns." So it's all cheery at the moment. Scott's really getting on well with the crew, and the wives have just turned up. Have you got any comments you'd like to make on that, Max?
It seems like a really jolly adventure, doesn't it, so far?
Yeah, maybe they're not taking it seriously enough, are they? I think it was this wise influence. I mean, if we recall in the last episode, his wife was saying, "Oh, you've got to go out there." And, you know, what wife would really be saying that if they understood the dangers that were involved? The wives should be saying, "We don't want you going anywhere near there. You've already done that once. Just stick with the Navy. That's bad enough." But they were like, no, you go out there. And I think they just had this unfailing belief in their husbands, which is a good thing,
also,
really.
But also, it is a venture that is, you know, really captures the imagination, you know, the idea of being the first person to get to the South Pole. And you can imagine that the wives wouldn't want to stay at home throughout the entire expedition. They would perhaps want to accompany their husbands as far as they could. And I would have thought that was a perfectly reasonable position for them to take up. And But it does seem like a very jolly expedition so far. And on the one hand, you could say, well, perhaps were they taking the whole thing seriously enough? But on the other hand, you could say, well, that probably would have done marvels for their morale. And they could then sort of at the last point wave goodbye to their wives and set off with a cheery heart, knowing that the amount of time that they were going to be separated was going to be as minimal as possible.
Yeah, and definitely, and also give good memories to the wives as well, just in case, you know, something tragic happens. In Scott's mail was a telegram sent from Madeira on September the 9th, 1910, and it was a telegram from Amundsen saying, "Beg leave to inform you, proceeding to the Antarctic, Amundsen." Scott was clearly troubled by this announcement. Scott and much of the public resented the fact that Amundsen's intentions appeared secretive in nature. He had raised money for the publicly proclaimed intention of going to the Arctic, managed to borrow the Fram from Nansen without payment, and then suddenly turned around to face the South Pole. When the news arrived that Peary and Hansen had reached the North Pole, Amundsen had felt left with little choice. And he said, "It was therefore with a clear conscience that I decided to postpone my original plan for a year or two and try to solve the last great problem, the South Pole." Amundsen was heavily in debt, and he knew if there were any chance to repay his debtors, a spectacular triumph would be needed. The Norwegians left Christiania on August the 9th, 1910, with 97 Greenland dogs, a hut in sections, and provisions enough for 2 years. When they arrived in Madeira, only two members of the crew, his brother Leon and the ship's commander, Lieutenant Nilsson, knew of his intentions. The rest of the crew assumed that they would be on their way to Buenos Aires and then northwards from there to the Arctic. But at Madeira, he informed the crew of his real plans and all consented to head for the south. Amundsen chose to sail directly for the Ross Sea, a non-stop voyage, so the telegram for Scott was left with instructions for it not to be sent until after the Fram had sailed. Once Amundsen left Madeira, he vanished into the unknown. Clements Markham put his spin on the situation when he stated that she, the Fram, has no more sailing qualities than a haystack. In any case, Scott will be on the ground and settled long before Amundsen turns up, if he ever does. On October the 15th, 1910, Markham reported to the Royal Geographic Society secretary that Amundsen had quietly got a wintering hut made on board and 100 dogs and a supply of tents and sledges. His secret designs must have been nearly a year old. They believe his mention of Punta Arenas and Buenos Aires is merely a blind and that he is going to McMurdo Sound to try to cut out Scott. If I were Scott, I would not let them land. But he is always too good-natured. So we've got all sorts of subterfuge here with the Norwegians trying to get there before them. And the Fram, I think that was that circular ship. So they don't think it's going to be very good, but they've got a different way of doing this. They're building the hut while they're on board. So when they get to where they're going, they've already got it prefabricated, actually made on board the boat. So that's pretty. That's pretty clever. That's cutting out some time there. Scott, still chasing money, went on to New Zealand via Sydney by way of ocean liner. Meanwhile, Teddy Evans resumed command of the ship as they left the harbour and full sail in full view of the Admiral's 13,000-ton flagship and the rest of the squadron. The Scots arrived in New Zealand on October 27th and were greeted by Clements Markham's sister, Lady Bowen, and her husband, Sir Charles. They stayed in Lyttelton with the expedition's agent, Joseph J. Kinsey. Kathleen wrote, "There we were for a happy fortnight, working and climbing with bare toes, and my hair down, and the sun, and my con, and all the expedition going well. It was good, and by night we slept in the garden, and the gods be blessed." The Terra Nova arrived and was promptly put into dry dock in order to fix the leak. The ship had her stores rearranged and repacked, with everything getting banded, red for the main party and green for the eastern one. The scientific instruments were checked and the hut was erected on land by the men who would have the job of setting it up at winter quarters. The three motor sledges, still in their crates, were lashed to the deck. Oates argued for 45 tons of food for the ponies, and the ponies and dogs were waiting with Bruce and Mears on Quail Island in Littleton Bay. Stalls were built for 19 ponies, while the 39 dogs were chained to bolts and stanchions on the ice house and the main hatch between the motor sledges. So it must have been difficult fitting all of this on the deck as well.
Yeah.
Scott managed to get 430 tons of coal into the holds and 30 more tons stacked in sacks on the upper deck. Oates managed to get an extra 2 tons of fodder on board without Scott's knowledge. In the ice house were 3 tons of ice, 162 carcasses of mutton, 3 of beef, and cases of sweetbreads and kidneys. Scientific instruments were everywhere, sledges, an acetylene plant, the wooden huts, clothing, 5 tons of dog food, and hundreds of other items had to be squeezed in. There was hardly any room left for the men. And of course, there were other minor details. It seems Petty Officer Evans got drunk again, as in Cardiff, and disgraced the ship. And then the day before the final departure from Port Chalmers, the other Evans came to Scott with details of trouble between the wives. Tempers had flared on the departure of their husbands, and Oates reported that Mrs. Scott and Mrs. Evans had a magnificent battle. They tell me it was a draw after 15 rounds. Mrs. Wilson flung herself into the fight after the 10th round, and there was more blood and hair flying around the hotel than you see in a Chicago slaughterhouse in a month. The husbands got a bit of the backwash, and there was a certain amount of coolness which I hope they won't be bringing into the hut with them. However, it won't hurt me, even if they do. Once at sea, however, all was well, and later Kathleen stated, if ever Con has another expedition, the wives must be chosen more carefully than the men. Better still, have none. Wise words there from Kathleen. So then we get to the farewell. On November the 26th, the Terra Nova sailed for Dunedin and Port Chalmers. The Scots did not sail with her, but came back in the harbour tug and spent their last 2 days together walking over hills to Sumner. The next day in the afternoon, it was time to say their goodbyes. There were massive cheering crowds on the shore as a tug took the three wives off into the distance. Wilson wrote of his wife, Ori, "There on the bridge, I saw her disappear out of sight, waving happily, a goodbye that will be with me till the day I see her again in this world or the next. I think it will be in this world and sometime in 1912. Kathleen wrote, "I didn't say goodbye to my man because I didn't want anyone to see him sad. On the bridge of the tug, Mrs. Evans looked ghastly white and said she wanted to have hysterics, but instead we took photos of the departing ship. Mrs. Wilson was plucky and good. I mustered them all for tea in the stern and we all chatted gaily, except Mrs. Wilson, who sat looking somewhat sphinx-like. The ship sailed at 4:30 p.m. on November the 29th, 1910, and for most of the men, it would be a year and a half before they would see any green living thing, while 5 others would never return." Well, I think we should leave that here for today, Max. And if you've got any final thoughts on that that you'd like to share?
Yeah, I think we can safely leave it there. I think it's you know, what we were saying about the expedition and it being a jolly expedition and you know, the wives then having like a bit of a spat at the end of it. That's kind of like par for the course, isn't it? When you have too good a party and perhaps too many people get a bit too drunk, that there's very often an argument or a fight at the end of things. And it would seem that the same kind of things prevailed even in those days, with people being as sensible as they possibly could be.
Yeah, and it seems as if they were really going at one another as well. At least they managed to make up in the end there. Well, we'll continue with that next week then. So thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
That's been good.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.